All right, guys, this morning we're going to start a two-part series, and then I think you should know, 2 weeks from Friday, 2 weeks from tomorrow is Good Friday, and we will be at the BCC, so we will not meet that week, but this week and next week we're starting a series, and it's really fascinating, and I was thinking about this morning. C.S. Lewis, in his book, Mere Christianity, has a section on the various, he calls them vices, I call them sins, and he kind of goes through and analyzes a host of them. If you go through the Bible, we could probably list all different types of sins that a human being commits. Then the early church had what was called the seven deadly sins. Well, I have, through all of my study as I was doing the research on this particular topic, I, and again, this is my opinion, all right? But I think there are three sins, or vices, if you want to call them that, that have a huge impact on our lives, maybe more so than any other. Again, that's my opinion. And I think I'm gonna make an argument on why I think they are so deadly and they have such an impact on us. But then the reason I'm sharing this as kind of an introduction is to really get to the topic that I want to examine today, which I'll get to in a minute, because this, what we're going to look at really is kind of an antidote for these particular sins. And you'll see what I mean as we get into them. Now, does anybody want to guess what these three sins might be?
One of them is pride.
Pride.
Self-righteousness.
Self-righteousness is a form of pride.
Greed.
Got one more.
Lust.
Yeah, we got a lot of lusts, but no, that's not it. That's an issue, though. Don't get me wrong.
Idolatry.
Nope. If idolatry probably would kind of override all of them. It starts with an E.
Envy.
Pride, greed, and envy. And there are a couple of reasons these are such deadly sins or vices. And the first is, and we've talked about this before, so you may have heard this, but the first reason they're so deadly is because they're so hard to detect in your life. Most people don't think they're guilty of any of these. I mean, how many people are you greedy? Nobody thinks they're greedy. I've got a control over the issue of money. C.S. Lewis, in Mere Christianity, says this about pride. He says, there is one vice of which, and by the way, do you know what the chapter is? This is the only chapter he talks about all these vices that he doesn't name the vice. Do you know what he calls it?
The great sin.
The great sin. And he says this, there is one vice of which no man in the world is free, which everyone in the world loathes when he sees it in someone else, and of which hardly any people ever imagine that they are guilty themselves. I've heard people admit that they are bad-tempered, or that they can't keep their heads about girls or drink, or even that they're cowards. But I don't think I have ever heard anyone who maybe was not a Christian accuse himself of this vice. And at the same time, I very seldom met anyone who was not a Christian who showed the slightest mercy to it in others. There is no fault which makes a man more unpopular, and no fault which we are more unconscious of in ourselves. And he says, and the more we have it in ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. And he says, the vice that I'm talking of is pride. And I think he's right on there. It's hard to detect it in your life. But what I found, as you become a Christian, as you grow spiritually, you do become aware of it. But still, it's hard to detect. That's why I think it's so important, guys, that we pray and ask God, Lord, show me the logs in my life. Matthew 7:3. Now take greed. This is the one that Keller thinks is the most of the vices that's the least obvious to us. Because he says that, he finds that through his own experience. He says, you know, here he is, a pastor in the largest church in New York City. I mean, probably 10,000 or more people. Most who are Wall Street types, and he says, you know, I have people come to me all the time sharing their problems and their issues. It may be addiction. It may be marital problems. It may be work problems. He says, in all my years here in New York, I've never had one person come to me and say, I'm struggling with greed. I'm struggling with the love of money. And he says, when he was giving a talk on the seven deadly sins, his wife predicted that when you get to greed, I predict nobody shows. He said, he disagreed with her. He said, sure enough, the time for the session on greed shows up. He said, almost nobody's there. And he said, he concluded, because nobody thinks it's a problem for them. Or maybe they're afraid to be confronted by it. And then you have envy. Think about it. Envy literally means to want somebody else's life. But the problem with envy, too, is we're blind to it. You see, these sins, these vices, guys, they're not visible to us. And for that reason, I think that's probably why they're so deadly. Now, second reason, I'm going to go through this. This is the introduction, by the way, to my talk. It's going to take a minute. In fact, it's going to take us a minute before we even get to any scripture. But the second reason that these sins are so deadly is because they lead to other sins. These sins lead to more visible sins in our lives. You see, pride, greed, and envy are sins below other sins, and they lead us to commit other sins. In other words, pride, greed, and envy lead to all types of sinful actions, visible actions. I mean, let's say somebody does something dishonest in order to maybe to land a big deal or land a big client. Clearly, they're aware, usually, unless they've killed their conscience, they're aware that they're doing something wrong. But they do it anyway. But the sin below that sin is greed. Or, if, I don't know how many of you remember Charlie Munger. You remember, I shared this when we talked about envy. Charlie Munger truly believed, he's Warren Buffett's number two guy. They're kind of partners. it's hard to believe he's older than Buffett. And yet remains amazingly sharp. But he says, you know, he is convinced that when you go back to particularly the housing crisis, the housing bubble, he said that most people believe it was a result of greed. He says, I'm convinced it was more envy. You know, all these big deal, these people that do all these big deals, you know, they might be making $3 or $4 million and they're feeling really good about themselves until they find out the guy right down the hall is making 7 or 8. And he said he believed it pushed them to create products that were not in the public interest and really were illegal. That's why you saw so many go to jail. But he said it wasn't greed as much as it was envy. Who knows? So these three vices are sins below the sin. And then finally, the reason that they're also so deadly, guys, is because of what it does to our hearts and our souls. You know, I really believe that these three vices can suck the joy out of your earthly existence. They can spoil your ability to enjoy life in the now. For instance, there was an article in Psychology Today that says that the most unhappy people in life are not those who have the most money. But they're convinced the most unhappy people in life are those who think about it the most, who long for it, who feel like they never have enough of it. He says those whose hearts are captured by greed. Of course, a perfect literary figure that really points this out is Ebenezer Scrooge. He had more money than everybody in the town, and yet he was the most miserable miser. Now, and when we talked about envy a couple of years ago, Tim Keller says envy can suck the joy out of your life like a great vacuum. Because he says this is what happens. You look out in the community, and you're not aware of this, but you look out in the community, and you see people who have better lives than you, or better kids than you, or better marriage than you, or better something, and you hate it. It can lead to true misery. I mean, I had a man, I remember meeting, sitting right down there where Perry is, and he was so, I met with him, and to, basically he was looking for some counsel. He was so angry and miserable because he said, I feel like God has discriminated against me. All my friends that I grew up have it so much better than I did. He hated it. And it truly poisoned his life. And then you've got pride. Again, Lewis calls it the anti-God state of mind. And one of the things about pride, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more in a minute, you're consumed by what other people think about you. Pride allows other people's opinions to be the gauge in which you measure your life. And pride causes so many men to have to try to fake it through life. Everything's great. Everything's wonderful. And pride makes men very, very insecure. It makes for a very unhappy life. So let me stop here. I've said a lot in just a couple of minutes. Any comments or questions on anything I've said?
Are you going to talk about the remedy?
That's kind of where we're headed, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it'd be pretty bad to say, all right, guys, that's it. Let's go home. Yeah. Anybody else?
You know, envy and pride are kind of tied together.
Well, you know,
leapfrog partners.
Yeah, in fact, that's a great. All three of these sins intersect. It's almost like they're like cousins. And maybe that's why that they're so deadly. But Steve's absolutely right. You're going to see how greed, the love of money, has to do with pride. I mean, they all intersect, as does envy. Anybody else? Well, I want to think through these before we get to, as Jim called it, the remedy. I call it the antidote, and I'll explain in a minute. But think of those who are captured by greed. In their minds, they don't have enough because they always want more. Why do you think that is? There's never enough. Even though they might have plenty, there's never enough. Why do you think that is? You want more than the next guy, and that's where pride comes in. You can see, again, that's where the intersection comes in. You want it all. It's just, yeah, it's always more. But if you think about it, people aren't stupid. In our minds, we recognize that money can bring certain things into our lives. And what happens is, and we become convinced that we can't be happy without these things. I mean, it may be a possession of some kind, a home or a vehicle. It may be some vacation that you've got to have, or the prestige that you think it'll bring. More money means more prestige. It may be security. But basically what psychologists will tell you is that we believe that money is important because it will bring a certain amount of well-being into our lives. And psychologists have a term. It's called subjective well-being. It's a great word. Subjective well-being. But with the term subjective well-being is the clinical word for happiness. And so there's this equation, and again, you don't logically think about this. It's just kind of deep down in our hearts that there's this ever increasing desire for more because we believe that that's what leads to my subjective well-being. Now, let's think through pride for just a minute. What's that about? People ask me whenever we talk about pride, well, isn't there a good side to pride? And I guess there is. And that you want to be the very best. There's that idea of being excellent. But that's not what the Bible speaks of when it talks about the vice of pride. It's an arrogance. It's about having to win the approval of others. It's about impressing. But listen to what Lewis says. Lewis says, and this is why, as Steve said, it's a cousin of envy, because it leads to comparing. It leads to comparing. Listen to what he says. Now, what you want to get clear is that pride is essentially competitive. It's competitive by its very nature, while the other vices are competitive only, so to speak, by accident. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good looking, but they're not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. You hear what he's saying? It's not that I just want to be wealthy. I just want to be wealthier than all of you guys. He says if everyone else became equally rich or clever or good looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest, feeling or being superior. And you know, a great example of this in the Bible is when Jesus shares probably my favorite parable. And that's the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector who go in the temple to pray. Both of them are going into the temple to pray. But in the and Jesus points out, and by the way, he's sharing this with the Pharisees. And of course, the irony, most people don't know the irony of this parable is that the Pharisees were the good guys in that culture, and the tax collectors were the bad guys. They're kind of like the IRS agent. And they were usually corrupt. And yet in this parable, you see that the Pharisee is the one that's corrupt because of his pride and his self-righteousness, and the tax collector, you see, his humility. But notice what he said. What does he do in the parable as it relates to pride? Remember what he says? He says, I thank you that I'm not like other people. The comparison's coming in. I thank you I'm not like other people. Swindlers, the unjust, the adulterers, or even like that tax collector. What was he thinking? He was comparing. He was saying, I am morally and spiritually superior to all these other people. In fact, I read where George Carey, who's the former Archbishop of Canterbury, made an observation about the parable. He says, this very religious, moral Pharisee who believed in God felt very good about himself. He was comfortable with his standing with God, yet his pride blinded him. He couldn't see the truth about himself. He didn't see the self-righteousness in himself. He says, his pride blinded him, and he did not realize that something was terribly wrong with his life. That's what pride does to you. It blinds us and keeps us from being able to see that there's something terribly wrong in our hearts if, in fact, it's captured by pride and arrogance.
Richard?
Yeah, Jim?
What if the tax collector, what if the Pharisee compared himself not to the tax collector, but to the Holy God?
Well, then he'd get it right. He'd get it right. Because when you do that, you realize just how far short you fall. Anybody else?
What did you say earlier? It is the comparison that makes you something and the pleasure of being better.
Let's see. He says it's competitive by it while the others. Let's see. Randy, I'm not sure. Why don't you send me afterwards and I'll see if I can find that for you. Anybody else? Perry.
I keep thinking about the verse that who regards you as superior? For what do you have?
That is one of the, that verse that Perry just shared, I think it's 1 Corinthians 4:7, captures pride. He says, why do you consider yourself superior to others when in reality everything you have you've received, basically saying you've received from God, it's a gift from God. And that right there kind of gives us kind of a glimpse into where we're going as far as the remedy. Anybody else? You know, this struck me. I wanted to share this. I think this is kind of interesting. Y'all know what this is? What does that look like?
A ladder.
Think about, I ask you to go back and think about when you first got out of school and started your career. Can you remember that?
Barely.
Yes, senility is setting in. But remember when you start your career and you start climbing the ladder of success, and you know, most of my peers that I graduated with from high school, we all started about the same time. And so you got, you know, one guy you might have here, and one guy's up here, and another one's down here. And, you know, life would be okay if all you had to do was keep your eye on the ball and keep your eye on your job and what you're doing and do good work, and the results just take care of themselves. You know the real problem with this? Is you can't just keep your eye on your ladder. You're always looking over and saying, how's he doing? That's what remember we talked about that in Ecclesiastes, how that happens. We always wonder, how's my neighbor doing? And Solomon says, we're driven by envy. But you know what struck me? You know what really struck me? What is the worst thing that could happen to a man as he's climbing the ladder? Fall off. He fails. He goes through failure. And he's down here and he's up. It really struck me. That is why failure is one of the greatest, I think it's the, other than the fear of dying, is man's greatest fear is failing. I was reading, I watched a TED Talk that the author of the Harry Potter series, what's her name? I can't remember her name. Yeah. It was a great talk, and she says, the thing that drove me, has always driven me, is the fear of failing. I couldn't believe it. David Sokol, who was supposed to take over for Warren Buffett, but unfortunately lost his job because he did something unethical. But there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about him, and he says, the thing that's always driven him is the fear of failing. There's something about that that terrifies men. And this, I think, part explains it, is that, you know, you can't just fall to the ground and say, all right, I'm going to start over. You're always wondering what other people are thinking about you. So it terrifies men. Then you get to envy. Again, it means to want someone else's life. What it means is you're not satisfied with who you are and what you have, so you're always looking at others. And therefore, you can see how, as we kind of analyze this, you really do see how these three sins do intersect. They're almost like they're cousins. They're related. And most of us are not even aware that they're there. But let me just say this final thing about envy. Joseph Epstein, who wrote a book about envy, says, learn what you envy and you will learn who you are. And then, I don't know if you remember, I shared this when we talked about envy. There are two components to envy. There's almost two sides to a coin. There's a sadness to envy and there's a joy to envy that works in reverse. There's a sadness when you see other people prospering and you're not. But then there's a joy when you see that's those same people experience misfortune. So these three sins, these three vices, can poison our lives. But when you're poisoned, if you ever take a poison and it doesn't kill you, when they get you to the hospital, they will inject you with what's called an antidote. An antidote, basically, is a medicine taken to counteract a particular poison. And this just dawned on me when I was preparing this. What I've been sharing with you now, up until now, is the introduction. But the antidote of these three maladies is simple. You may want to guess?
Humility.
Humility is tied to this, Randy, no doubt about it. In fact, humility is, can't get anything better than that. Gratefulness, it's contentment, which is very biblical, which we're going to see. It's this finding contentment in your life. For instance, in Mere Christianity, Lewis says this. He says, pride is spiritual cancer. What pride does, he says, it eats up the possibility of being content. Now, if that's true, guys, logically thinking through this, if you can find contentment in life, it will eat up the cancer of pride. Think about it. If you are content with who you are, really content with who you are, you don't have a need to impress anybody.
I think it's easy to do that if you focus on what you're grateful for.
Gratitude is clearly a part of this, and we're going to look at how does a person become content. That, we're going to really look at that next week.
Richard.
Jim.
It seems to me like contentment is the goal, is the destination. It's not necessarily the process to get there.
I would agree. Where you want to get is where you are truly content with who you are and what you have. Let me go back. Think about this as it relates to envy. R.C. Sproul, who I think is one of the great theologians of our day, says basically, if you want to know you're content, he says one sure indicator that reveals a person who is truly content with his life, he says, is when this person sees his friends and peers doing well and prospering, and he truly rejoices with them, and he's happy for them. And on the other hand, when he sees them struggle or go through really difficult times, he feels their pain and has great compassion for them. In other words, he hurts for them. In other words, what Sproul is saying is that contentment eradicates envy. You see, contentment means you are content not only with who you are, but what you have. We said earlier, greed believes you never have enough. Greed always craves more, always desires more. Contentment says, I am content with where I am and what I have. That's why in Hebrews 13:5, which we're going to look at in a minute, says, let your way of life be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. And guys, I pray that throughout the week. God, give me contentment. Let me be content with what I have. In fact, I pray the verse. Let your way of life, some translations say, let your character be free from the love of money. Lord, I pray that you would make that a reality in my life, that I would be content with what I have. Comment. Yeah, Robert.
I might say this wrong, but you still have to have a little bit of competitive nature in you, don't you? And want to win and drive. Show your kids, have some pride, clean yourself up before you go out.
That's why I always like to try to distinguish. When I bring up pride, because that I get that question, and that's a natural question to ask. In fact, if you read my blog this week on the art of achieving and growing and developing, self-discipline and effort are such a part of that. I think the question is that when you achieve, and when you do well, that you don't feel, it doesn't create in you a sense of superiority that I'm better than you. What it should do, and this is kind of what Randy was saying, is where the proper response is to have gratitude. That, Lord, I realize that all the talent, all the ability, all the opportunities, they're a gift from you, and I'm grateful for them. But it's a good question, and it's a legitimate question. Anybody else? All right. Yeah, Warren.
One verse that's helpful for me on that is when we do achieve and when we do work hard, I can't remember the verse, but it's to treat it like a soldier treats it. I have just done my duty based upon what's been given to me. Because I think we all tend to think I'm great because I've done it. Really, I've been given something and I've achieved. because of what's been given.
Yeah. Amen. Well said. Well said. Well said. Anybody else? All right. I want to look at some verses, but I want to do this a little differently. And if I could do it over again, I would have scanned this and sent it to you in advance, but then I'd have kind of given away what I was talking about in the first. But in order to keep, and I want you to take this and take it home with you, because I want you to really read it and study it. But there's a three different scriptures, there's a number of verses on contentment. And I'm going to pass these out. And I did this so that we wouldn't have to be flipping around and looking at them. I want to let everybody get a copy. And then I'm going to read them. All right? And I want to ask you as we read them, how do these really apply to what's been said so far? Everybody got, we got enough? I got plenty of them. Is everybody there? Everybody got it? Now, before I read, let me just say this, that in Greek, as you read, that you'll see the word content or contentment here. The Greek word that's used is autarky, which is autarkei. And what it means is to be full, to be satiated, to be satisfied. And it's not a satiation, obviously, of the body, like you eat a meal. It's a satiation or satisfaction of the soul. And it leads to a peace and a tranquility in your life. Tim Keller says it's a deep, I like this, he says it's a deep calm and equilibrium. And if you think about it, particularly as you get to be our age, I mean, isn't this what everybody really yearns for and really wants and desires? The problem is, we're a culture that's not finding it. In fact, I would say because of greed, pride, and envy, I think explains why there's so much misery in this life. Now, I want to read these verses. And because they're all laid out here, we can just kind of look at them. And as I read it, I'd ask you to try to notice in these verses, how are they pertinent to everything that's been said this morning? And what do we learn about contentment from these verses? I'm going to read them, and then I'm going to open it up and see, what do you see in here that relates to what we've been talking about? The first verse is Hebrews 13:5. Let your way of life, or again, as some translations say, let your character be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you or forsake you. The second is 1 Timothy 6:6-10. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when it's accompanied by contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. That kind of reminds me of that what I shared from that Psychology Today article. For the love of money, not money, guys. Notice it says, for the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. And then finally, and the most important, I think, which we will really look at closely the next time we meet, is Philippians 4:11-13. Paul says, I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned, this is crucial, I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether I'm well fed or whether I'm hungry, whether I'm living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. What do you see here, guys? And again, I wish I'd given you more time. And so I want you to take this back because we're going to come back to these next week. But anything in particular jump off the page as it relates to pride, greed, and envy? Yes, Dan?
The last thing you read about being content when you have plenty.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And that's part of this secret because, you know, most people think, I mean, in fact, what we've been talking about is that even when you have plenty, you want more. And he's talking about the ability to be content whether you're in want or whether you have plenty. And by the way, I was reading this morning a commentary on one of these verses, and this was interesting. This comes from, I'm drawing a blank, John Newton, you know, the slave trader who became a Christian, wrote the song Amazing Grace. There was a movie made by his life. And he recognized, as you look at these verses where it says, you know, if you have food or covering, with these you can be content. And this was kind of interesting. He broke down the things in life, the possessions in life, into three categories. He says you have the necessities, and he was drawing from this verse in 1 Timothy. He says you have necessities. Then he says you have conveniences, and then you have luxuries. He says what Paul is saying is that at a minimum you need your necessities to be content, which is true. It's hard to be content if you live out on the street or if you're starving to death. But he says at a minimum you need the necessities and you can find contentment. And, you know, I think he's right. And I think I'm seeing that a lot of people recognize this because I'm talking to more and more people who are saying, you know, I want to downsize my life at this point. I want to have a simpler life. Because I think there's a recognition the simpler my life is, the more content I'll be. Yeah, Paul?
Isn't there, maybe it's a fault of mine, but isn't there contentment in the joy of competition?
Well, let's go back because this goes back to what Robert asked. There's nothing wrong with competition. I think there is a joy in competition. I don't know if I'd call it a contentment, but there's no doubt, you know, that there's something about competing that brings that creates a joy.
As long as you don't lose.
As long as you don't lose. but that, you know, that's a whole different matter. And what Lewis talks about the competitive side is not that it breeds joy. But what it does to you when you're comparing and you feel like I need to be better than you, I need to be superior to you, which is our natural tendency because of our depravity. Anybody else?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I don't know if y'all seen the commercial, the DirecTV commercial about the settlers. You know, see this family over there that like lives out in the sticks, you know, whatever, and they're settling for just the necessities of life, and they make fun of them.
Y'all know what he's talking about?
You got to have direct TV.
Yeah.
Direct TV.
Yeah, Randy.
As we've gone through today's lesson, I keep having these images of the pictures, your idea of what things should be like.
What you want your life to be.
What they're really like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in fact, I shared that yesterday, that very same thing, because, you know, the picture is the way we want life to be, and life goes well. We're content when reality and our picture are congruent. But where our lives go crazy is when they're not, when the picture blows up, and that's true. And so that's kind of where we're heading, Randy, this. How, even when the picture blows up, you know, how do we find contentment? You going to say something, Jim?
I was going to say, all these things you talked about, like money, worldly success, athletic success, all of those things are good in and of themselves, but they're part of the creation.
Yeah.
And we're built to live in relationship with the Creator. And if we want contentment, ultimately, that's where it's got to come from. Those other things just can't carry the water. They want, you know, like I was thinking when y'all were talking about athletics, Tiger Woods, he was the best guy ever. You know where he is?
Yeah. Yeah. Great point. Excellent.
Is it actually from the things that we've been studying? You always do that thing with God in the center and all these folks coming out from him, but is it actually possible to have contentment without having God in the center?
I'll answer that next week, but it's pretty self-evident. No, yeah, we're about out of time. Let me share this, then I'll see what you have, and it'll lead us into next week. But you know, I think when it gets right down to it, as you read these scriptures, true contentment has nothing to do with what you have. You see, in our world, I think people believe that peace and contentment are based on what you have. And that I can be content in this life only if I have, as in Paul's words, plenty. I can't be content if I'm in want or need. And Paul's saying that's not necessarily true. And that I think what I just shared explains the greed. You know, I've got to have this if I'm truly going to be happy and content. But Paul says this isn't so. That's why he speaks of godly contentment. Of being contentment in all situations, in all circumstances, you know, which for some people is just hard to believe. But I think the crucial words, and this is kind of where we're going with this, the crucial words are in verse 12 of Philippians 4, where he says this, I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation. Now, when you say I've learned the secret, what he's saying is, this is not self-evident. This isn't real obvious. This doesn't come through common sense. This is a great spiritual truth that we have got to figure out and discern. And he says, I've learned the secret. And so what we're going to look at is, what is that secret? What has he really learned?
Richard, I think about some of the professional athletes, you know, like Deion Sanders, making millions of dollars, access to girls in every city.
Yep.
He almost committed suicide.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that next week too. I mean, that's a really good point. And
look where he is now. Yeah. Professes to be a faithful servant.
Yeah, and I don't know that much about Dan, but I did hear that he had become a Christian, but we're going to look at, I mean, and read one of Keller's old sermons, he asked the question, why, and he used the example of this, of Kurt Cobain, because this was when the sermon was preached, he had just committed suicide, who had everything. You know, how is it, Robin Williams, how do all these people that have it all, why would they take their life? It makes no sense. We'll talk about that next time. I'm going to wrap this up, guys. I want to end with this thought. If pride, greed, and envy can be somewhat nullified in our lives, you can never eradicate it. But think about the life that you can live. Think about the life you can live if you truly are content. And we'll look at the secret of finding contentment next week.